Hello, Happy New Year. I'm Rachel Zucker, your host of Commonplace, and this is episode 44 with Matthew Zapruder. Poet, translator, professor, and editor Matthew Zapruder is the author of 6 books, most recently the poetry collection Sun Bear, and a prose investigation into reading and writing poetry called Why Poetry. Matthew lives in Oakland with his wife and young son. He teaches at St. Mary's College of California. From 2016 to 17, Matthew was editor of the New York Times Magazine Poetry Column, a rotating annual position. With Brian Henry, Matthew Zapruder co-founded Verse Press, which later became Wave Books, where he is editor at large. Matthew is also the series editor of the Bagley Wright Lecture Series that invited and funded 6 mid-career poets to write and deliver lectures on poetics across the country. The lecture series was named after Bagley Wright, father of Charlie Wright, publisher of Wave Books. I've known Matthew a long time. I don't remember where or how we met, but in the early 2000s, Matthew invited me to read at the KGB bar. I read new, long poems that Matthew liked very much. After the reading, he asked if I had a book ready, and if so, would I send it to him? Such a thing had never happened to me. It felt like what I imagined being discovered felt like, the thrill of being wanted, the flattery of someone seeing something in you. Previously, I'd been an industrious poet, sending my work out, getting rejected, sending it again, sending my first book out for years before Wesleyan agreed to publish it, a process that took several more years. Another time, I'll tell the story of how my second and third books came to be published, also by Wesleyan, but for now, I'll just say it was no easy feat. When Matthew asked me for a manuscript, my third book, then twice as long as it ended up being, was under consideration at Wesleyan and several other places. I ended up splitting that manuscript and writing new poems. Wesleyan published The Bad Wife Handbook, and 2 years later, Wave published Museum of Accidents. Matthew was my editor for Museum of Accidents and for my next book, The Pedestrians. He was also my editor for the Bagley Wright Lectures that I wrote and delivered in 2016 to 2017 and am currently revising for publication. In my experience, relationships with editors and publishers are always complex. They often involve moments of conflict, hurt feelings, miscommunication, as well as moments of excitement, collaborative problem solving, and enormous gratitude that someone is not only publishing your work, but making it better. Publishing is a vulnerable and delicate activity. I've been published by 5 presses and have worked with many editors at those presses and at journals. I've also republished one of my own books and been a reader or judge for prizes, book contests, admissions applications, and now, as the host, creator, and one of the producers of Commonplace, this is another new editorial adventure. I spoke to Julie Carr in episode 24 a little bit about working with her and her press counterpath on my book Mothers. I spoke with Carmen Jimenez-Smith in episode 31 about her own poetry, her relationship with her editor at Grey Wolf, and also about her editorial role at Noemi Press, which she started with her husband, Evan Lavender Smith, in 2002. So I've touched on the editor-writer communication and relationship in several other conversations, but I haven't delved deeply into what I think, for most writers, is a really important but not largely publicly talked about part of the process of art and bookmaking. So when Matthew was coming to New York to read from and talk about his new book, Why Poetry, we decided to record a Commonplace conversation as part of his book tour. I spoke with Matthew at NYU about 20 minutes after he had finished being on the Leonard Lopate show and the day after hearing Matthew's fabulous lecture based on his book Why Poetry at NYU. This conversation is shorter than most of the Commonplace episodes. I ended up doing more editing than usual as Matthew and I went down some strange conversational cul-de-sacs that he thought would not be very interesting to listeners and which didn't represent either of us well. Sometimes, while editing these conversations, I get a mental picture of the shape or quality of the conversation. Sometimes it seems like my guest and I are peeling an onion layer by layer, or I picture the guest and I falling together through a wormhole. Or the conversation sparks and sizzles and jumps like an electrical impulse from axon to dendrite. The picture that came to mind when I was editing this conversation was one of those lava lamp-like contraptions where one color of liquid moves around, sometimes splitting into smaller pearls, other times consolidating into a larger blob, but never diffusing evenly into the clear liquid around. Matthew and I skitter around each other in this conversation, making interesting patterns. You'll hear us dancing around nervously, perhaps about the terms of engagement, about how much we want to get into our complicated relationship, or why, how, whether it is complicated. At one point, this complication is evidenced by our difficulty agreeing about whether or not complicated is the right word. Matthew has a beautiful mind about poetry, a clear, erudite way of lecturing and speaking about his own poems and the poems he loves. If you want to hear Matthew speak at greater length than he does in our conversation about his newest book, Why Poetry, I recommend the short Leonard Lopate interview, or even better, Matthew's hour-long interview with David Naiman on David Naiman's podcast, Between the Covers, which is absolutely superb. In our conversation, you'll hear Matthew talk about being an editor and a poet, about how he came to ask himself, can I write a poem that doesn't hold itself away from anyone, but that does everything I love in poetry? And how that question led to his third book of poems, and then eventually his recent book, Why Poetry. In our conversation, you'll hear two people mystifying themselves and each other as they try to understand each other and themselves as they try to be in service of the love of poetry. And you will hear Matthew read some wonderful new poems. Oh, we mentioned Jeff Schatz and Michael Wiegers without explaining who they are. Jeff Schatz is executive editor at Grey Wolf Press, which has published many of the writers on Commonplace, including Nick Flynn, Claudia Rankine, Sarah Manguso, Steph Burt. Michael Wiegers is executive editor at Copper Canyon Press, which has published several Commonplace authors as well, Natalie Diaz, Roger Reeves, Javier Zamora, Dinez Smith, and of course, Matthew Zapruder. A huge shout out to both of these editors and to Grey Wolf and Copper Canyon, and of course to Wave Books for making such wonderful books and for supporting Commonplace with so much enthusiasm. We have terrific patron extras for this episode. Patrons will have exclusive access to sound files of Matthew reading from his work. Patrons will be entered into a Commonplace raffle that contains copies of Secret Weapon, selected late poems of Eugene Zebelanu, co-translated by Matthew Zapruder, courtesy of Coffeehouse Press, copies of Pink Thunder, a musical and lyrical experiment by Michael Zapruder, Matthew's brother, with contributions from 23 poets, 3 engineers, and over 30 musicians, courtesy of Black Ocean Press, some broadsides of a poem by Matthew Zapruder, and signed copies of the poem that Matthew Zapruder and Matthew Rohrer wrote together for Ai Weiwei that Matthew Z and I talk about early on in this episode. Also in the raffle are Matthew's books of poetry, The Pajamist, Come On All You Ghosts, and Sun Bear, courtesy of Copper Canyon, Why Poetry, courtesy of Echo Books, as well as some fabulous books donated by Wave Books. Thank you so much to Copper Canyon, Wave, Coffeehouse Press, Black Ocean, and all the presses who support Commonplace. Won't you consider becoming a patron of this podcast? To do so, visit patreon.com/commonplacepodcast or commonpodcast.com today. Here's my conversation with Matthew Zapruder. There's something kind of interesting about you being placed in between Ai Weiwei and Tracy Ullman.
Perfect. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was really, it was cool. He was sitting in there and actually Matt Rohrer, I texted Matt. Actually, Matt texted me because he was listening and he was very excited.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were like, let's write him a poem. And so we started texting each other. We wrote a poem by text for him.
Do you have it?
I don't have the finished version unless Matt emails it to me.
Oh, but, man.
I mean, we. All I mean, right, it just.
Maybe we can put it on later.
Yeah, if it's yeah. But we so we were kind of listening to what he was saying, and then, you know, taking little phrases and making up our unusual stuff, and that was fun.
Yeah, you did good.
Did I do okay?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, I felt like it was really firing questions at me.
Yeah, well, that
like fast.
Yeah,
I was like.
And sometimes he was doing that thing where he like includes the answer in the question, like, well, do you think there's a problem with the way that poetry is being taught today? And you were great about it, you know, because it was sort of like a fishing expedition, like waiting for you to say like, yeah, high school teachers suck. And you're like, no. Yeah, right. Of course there is a problem, but that's not like the problem. And it's more complicated than that. But right. I also understand like he seemed to have like, you know, 26 minutes or two, you know,
super well. I actually was surprised. I didn't think he would be that on it. I mean, he switched from Ai Weiwei to like, you know, and I would figure we'd just sort of be like, so what's your book about? You know, like poetry. I, you know, like Robert Frost. What about you? You know, I figured it'd be like that thing, which would have been totally fine. But instead he was like, define defamiliarization. You know, like,
right.
I was like, whoa, negative capability, go.
Yeah. And, yeah, but so you were incredibly good at that. I was kind of astonished because I was like, oh, well, wait till you get to, you know, Commonplace where it's really like, so let's talk about your book.
Right.
I just really do feel like compared to Leonard Lopate, not that that's, you know, my goal in life, although I quite like what he does and I like his show.
It's different.
But I was like, wow, I'm listening to two very articulate and sharp people.
Jews.
Yeah, but also like I definitely felt like, wait, why does he seem so smart and quick? No, because he was really firing those questions at you, and
it was a topic
responding.
That I happened to be on about my book. I mean, if it had been about something else, I would have been like, No, I mean, I was like, I guess I'm used to being cross-examined by older Jewish men. You know, it's like a dinner every night dinner that happened. So I was well prepared. No, I mean he was. I mean it was. Yeah, I felt funny because it was also like a tiny bit like, what's the right word? Like it was a little like suspicious.
Yeah.
He wanted to be like, come on.
Yeah.
A little bit, which I mean I appreciate that. You know. So.
Well, do you think that was more because it was like, you know, oh man, who booked this poet on my show? How am I going to present him and his ideas to a general audience? And like,
no, I don't think he books anything he doesn't want to book. Yeah. I don't think that's how that works. This is the whole thing with the book. It's like people with poetry, it just kind of puts them on the wrong foot a little bit sometimes. And they can get a little like afraid, not afraid is the wrong word, but they just like, it's in that do I know enough space. Mm-hmm. And different people react differently to that space. There's some people who really kind of capitulate when there's any fear that they might not know something. And then there's some people who become more, you know, like they want to define the situation. And I think that was more that sort of thing. It was like, he's not an expert in poetry, but he certainly knows stuff about it. And so he was like, I'm going to you know, control the situation or whatever. So
right.
I don't know. I'm just like psychoanalyzing this guy. I mean, it was cool. I love the show. I've listened to it a million times. It's important in situations like that not to think about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I was like, wait a minute. Like, how did I like crawl through the radio and like get on the other side of it? It's like, that's very, I'm not supposed to be here. So I definitely, and after seeing Ai Weiwei and it was so funny. I walk in there and it's very rushed because, you know, it's like we have like 30 seconds to do the changeover. And I say my go-to thing whenever I see a famous person whose work I really like, I always say the same thing, which is thank you for your work.
Mm-hmm.
I decided that was like my thing I was going to say because
it's a good thing.
The first time I had that experience, I was like, you're the bath. So I like always say, I had this like from now on, I'm just going to say. So I said that to him and then he kind of was like bowed and he was like, my father was a poet, you know, thank you. You know, like for, and I was like, actually, dude, thank you.
Wow.
Thank me. I mean, it wasn't about my poetry. It was about just respect for poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm sitting there and kind of trying to absorb that experience. And then this guy comes rushing back and he's like, wait, you forgot your hoodie. So it's like his hoodie gets passed around. And I was like, there's a moment where I was just like, wanted to just like grab it and be like, you can't have it.
Oh my God.
So it was a very, so I was kind of like very weirded out,
mm-hmm.
like in a cool way. And then suddenly was like, Leonard Lopate's like talking to me and I'm thinking this is weird.
Are you
weird.
In the same room with him?
Yeah, yeah. Just like this. Yeah.
Same distance?
No, a little farther away, yeah. Which is good. There's kind of a big round table and there's a lot of machinery and...
Yeah.
And
we're a little close.
We're a little close. It's good though. but there's a lot of also like, whatever, it's boring. But like there were like a million people in the green room who work with Ai Weiwei, right?
Uh-huh.
And then I'm look out the window and Tracy Ullman's standing outside the window on her cell phone while I'm talking to
wow.
her.
Wow.
I was like, it was so hard for me not to say, I love Tracy Ullman.
Well, did you say thank you for your work to Tracy Ullman?
I didn't. She was on the phone. Oh. So instead, I don't know why I did this. It was fucking absurd. But she was on her phone. She's like not a tall person. And for those not here in this room, I'm 6'3". So I got down on one knee and I was like, and I just said, I just mouthed the words, thank you.
Oh my God.
And she cracked
through the
up.
Glass?
No. When I walked out, I did that because she was on the phone. And then her assistant, I went into the green room, her assistant was cracking up. She was just like, that is hilarious that you did that. But like, what was I going to do? Just walk by right by Tracy Ullman?
I don't know. In the John Hughes version of this scene, I picture you on one knee, like making a heart somehow on the glass.
Oh
with
my
your finger.
God, that would have been better. See, yeah, you should have been there.
That would be nice.
You should have been there. I would have done that. She looked great. She was like, and she had a big smile on her face. She was on the phone. I was like, that's fucking Tracy Ullman, man.
Yeah.
And like, do you remember like, she was weird. She was like that was like the first really weird TV show or one of the first really weird TV shows. And we were like, oh, like comedy isn't always like, don't you hate it when the cotton balls, you know, get stuck in the cotton ball dispenser, you know, like that kind of thing. Right. Or like, oh, my wife, she's so bad at cooking. You know, that kind of like Bob Hope shit. Uh-huh. You know, so like Tracy Ullman was like this anarchist.
Yeah.
And it was, and then of course The Simpsons came out of that. And so, you know, it was like do you remember that? It was like a little break
in
that
show.
So, yeah. Anyway, it was pretty cool to see her.
So not everybody just heard you on the Leonard Lopate show like I did. And my experience of it was so New York. I was coming down here to meet you and record this conversation. And so I treated myself to a ride share instead of taking the subway because I had all this equipment and I wanted to make sure that I could hear you. And so if I knew if I went underground, I might lose you. And so I'm like there with my headphones on, listening to you talk about poetry, like on the way to talk to you about poetry, you know, going through the streets of New York and
That's
listening to
cool.
you talk to Leonard Lopate, you know, who I listen to all
Very
the time.
New York-y.
And then sort of, you know, I loved that he was sort of vying for a personalized poetry recommendation, but didn't really have time.
And I was like, I'm going to need to get to know you a little bit. It's like, we can't jump right into this.
I know.
Yeah.
There's foreplay involved,
I know,
Leonard.
Come on. We're not just going to just start doing it.
I know. But then, of course, you know, you went with the good standby choice of Frank O'Hara.
Sure. I mean, come on.
And I felt like, oh, this is kind of like this weird... 2017 Frank O'Hara moment where I'm
were like Frank O'Hara.
Yeah, I was like I was like, I've got, you know, I'm listening to this and I've got, you know, I'm in this car and I'm seeing, you know, we went from the Upper West Side to the Upper East Side down the East Side, which is not normally where I go, into the Village.
Did you go past the UN building? Because you could think of Skylar if you did that.
Oh, I could.
Yeah. Well, we should say, I mean, you know.
But let's talk about...
Well, we know each other really well. That's the other thing. It's like, you know, it's like, so you... That's a weird thing when you hear somebody on the radio. I've had this experience a lot with you because I've been listening to your podcast. And it's like funny when somebody you know really well from all these different places comes into your earphones in a certain sort of way. It's like that's a part... It's like a facet of them.
Yeah.
You're hearing.
Is it... let me ask you about that, which is weird. Because I'm asking you about myself.
This is really like infinite regression. We're going to go to a mirror store later.
What's that like for you to listen to me? Because you have a really interesting perspective. And this is a weird part or this conversation is, in for me, in a lot of ways, unlike the other conversations that I've had, because, and I was trying to explain this to you, or like, or verbalize this, about the way in which I feel like I know a lot about you and really not a lot about you at all. And you, I mean, you know, you, you're the only one who's like, read my new manuscript, and you've read my lectures, and then, you know, we have our personal...
I'm not the only one who's read your new manuscript, but among a small group of people, for
yes.
sure.
Yes, yeah. Well, you're certainly the only one who I've talked to for Commonplace who has.
Oh, right, okay.
And so, in some ways, like, okay, well, you know, I have a much more intimate relationship in certain ways with Sharon Olds, and a different kind of relationship, although it's very one-sided, with someone like Alice Notley, and, you know, D.A. Powell is like a real, you know, we've spent all this
hangout
time together.
Right, but you don't have a professional relationship with them.
Right. And so that's super interesting.
If we can call it a professional relationship, I guess we
could
call it.
Well, yeah, why can't we call it?
I guess we can. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's so my the first part of the question is, what's it like for you to hear me do these conversations with both in terms of like your perspective on me, but also with poets that you've read or that you know well, or that you know, what is that? Are there moments where you're listening and you're like, oh my God, she's totally, I don't know. Oh, she's doing that thing. I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. I didn't know where you were going with that. I don't never had that reaction. I mean, there are lots of times I'm listening and I think, well, first of all, I mean, I'm always interested to listen because you have interesting people on, and it doesn't. And I do know a lot of the people, but there's some people I don't know at all, and or I only know their work, or you know, or something. And so it's really, and you know, but there's some people you have on, like Alice Notley or something, who I like have had this huge long reading life with, and so it's, you know, in a sense, meaning I've read her through my whole life as a poet, or a lot of it, and so yeah, I mean, I think that. Yeah, I mean, to be totally honest, I mean, there's lots of times where I, not lots of times, but there's plenty of times where I'm like, I totally don't see things that way, or that's like, I don't agree with that, or that's not how I think of poetry. Not like, and those times, it's not like, oh, I think that's wrong. I just like, that's not how, and that's interesting for me, because I'm like, wow, that is like, I would never say that about poetry, or like never say that about, but there's lots of times when I find myself saying, oh, that's so cool, or that's kind of, I sort of had that thought, but now I, you know, so it's like, yeah, it's like anything else that's interesting, like a sustained engage, you know, be like reading an anthology or reading a book of interviews or something. You're like, there's, you have like different sorts of moments. I don't get like upset if I don't agree or something. In a way, it's actually kind of interesting. And then there's, yeah. And then there's people who I feel like I got to know a lot better, like through listening. So yeah, I don't know.
And
I like it. I mean, if I didn't like it, I wouldn't keep listening.
Yeah. Well, also, I guess if you didn't like it, you wouldn't want to be doing it right now. So that's sort of like a second part of my question.
Yeah, of course.
Like, what do you hope's going to happen? Like, is it more about
laughter, tears? I don't know. I think it's a little bit of a risky thing for us to do, because we do have, you know, not only do we have I wouldn't say complicated, but I mean, you know, we've had
I would say complicated.
Well, complicated's okay. I mean, but like, I don't necessarily mean that pejoratively. It's just, it's just a lot of things. And also, you know, what is, you know, we've had a relationship where your last two books, you know, I was heavily involved in editing, and those processes were often contentious, but in a way that I think was productive ultimately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the results were great. So both, I think, for in terms of the books themselves, and also just for your life as a writer, and the results were great for Wave and everything. So, and then we did this whole lecture thing together, which was kind of crazy, which you can maybe you should explain that in a second. But and then now there's this new book, although I'm not as involved with the new book and editing it, because I'm sort of stepping back a little bit from some of the editorial responsibilities I will continue to edit at Wave. It's just I'm so busy with, you know, having a young child and full-time teaching job and my own writing, that's just like, there's some things I have to just step away from. And so, but The other odd thing, of course, is that I appear in your manuscript in not the necessarily the most flattering ways at times. So that's a kind of interest. But again, which isn't like, you know, I'm not like, I mean, whatever, we should talk about that, but it's not like I'm, yeah. But I was kind of like, huh, that's interesting. Like,
yeah.
Like you're going to actually have the real me in front of you and not the, you know, version in your poems. That's different.
Is your hope or fantasy that you will be able to be the real you, in the podcast in a way that will, you know, we've talked about this, that when you appear in my poems, that makes it sound very passive. When I write about you,
right,
or bring
from
you
my
into
perspective,
the
when
poems,
I appear, from your perspective,
right,
when you write it, yeah.
Right. That you are always a representation of you, that my representation of you, which may or may not be accurate.
It can't really.
Well, right. Right. Or even if it's accurate to me, it's one part of you, and it yes. may also, and I we've talked about this before, that it's never, from my point of view, a misrepresentation, but I'm very aware of the fact that it's a projection onto you, more so even than other people who appear in my poems maybe my version of them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think you bring up something interesting. First of all, I mean, presumably you'll talk about this in your introduction, so you'll contextualize our conversation,
yeah.
But I mean, we haven't...
Thanks for giving me some instructions about that.
No, I'm not giving you instructions. I'm just worried that this conversation will be obscure.
It's true, and we went right to a very sort of...
So I'm just going to step back and say that, you know, we're peers... We are more or less the same age. We've published more or less the same stuff, and we've kind of moved in the same circles. And then at Wave Books, I edited your most recent two books of poetry, and then there's a forthcoming book of poetry. And also, after I started this Bagley Wright lecture series, you were one of the original six people I asked to do it. So we've worked closely in a lot of different ways, and in various ways in your writing, I have appeared. That's why,
right.
That's what we're talking about. Cause I think that might not be necessarily clear. Along with a lot of other people, by the way, I don't mean to imply that like your books are like exclusively, I mean, that would be kind of weird.
Right.
There's a big cast of characters in your writing, and I periodically will make an appearance.
Right. Okay. And that was good context. Now I don't have to put that in the introduction.
Sorry, I'm like so anxious. I'm like,
I'm
afraid it's not going to be understandable.
Yes.
Which is maybe a good thing to get into later. You
know, yeah.
About
okay.
my fear of that in general, about writing and about,
yes.
about, you know, audience or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, so
no, I think
maybe hyper aware of audience.
Right. And the one thing I was going to add to that context, which I thought was very helpful, is that, yes, you appear in my poems along with many other people, but in large part you appear in my poems as part of that editorial relationship.
Right, right.
And so it's a kind of like a doubled... thing, right? It's not like, oh, the other day I was hanging out with Matthew Zapruder,
right.
And
we don't live in the same city,
right.
We don't really hang out,
right?
But no, that is important. That's important to say, because it gets to what you were saying. You said, I think, a few minutes ago, you basically were sort of, I think, asking me about whether, you know, how I might appear in this podcast with like. Be like almost like a corrective or something,
right?
Or
like you could set the story straight, no. Or you could, or,
no,
or
I wasn't
or,
worried about that,
or that you could, you know, I mean, it's interesting because I think part of why you appear and or part of why I write you into the poems is because you are actually have been my editor, and you have from my perspective a lot of power over me. And that power dynamic is really interesting to me, and it's both actual from my perspective, but it's also a stand-in for other power dynamics in my life or how I think about power.
Yes.
And so I think, but you know, I'm working through something about how I feel about power, about having power over other people having power over me, and that's that's not really how you see yourself. Or it's a, you know, it's, so you, you know, and we've talked about the way in which that's, you know, you're in some ways you're not three dimensional in my representation of you, because I'm only talking about how I feel.
Yeah, well, you always
about,
call me your editor.
Yeah.
Which I think is so funny. You say my editor, that's what you call it, which is just so funny because it's like, it's, I have a lot of roles in my life. I'm a father, I'm a professor, I'm a poet, I'm a friend, I'm a, you know, whatever, all kinds of things. And Rachel Zucker's editor is low on the list of my identity things, mm-hmm. but you know, not number one.
Right.
So when you read a book and that's the only way you're called, it's kind of a funny experience, but I get why. I mean, I'm not like, but I also think it's funny that you say that I have a lot of power over you. And I mean, I because I don't experience it that way, because I mean, what happened is that I offered basically to publish a book of yours of poems that hadn't even been written yet. Mm-hmm. And then I think was pretty supportive of you as you were. And there were things I said I liked better than other things, whatever, but that's just what all editors do, whatever. And then we published that book, and then you brought another book and we published it. And then I asked you to do something and you did it. And then there's another book that we're publishing, you know? So, I mean, yes, in theory, I suppose I do, but the reality of the situation is that, you know, I haven't really exerted much of that authority in a way that is, I mean, maybe you feel like I have. I mean, that's, but it's just, it's just funny, because my feeling about being an editor in general is that my job is to support and encourage and push a little bit, and to be, and once wave or we get behind someone, we want to make sure they don't feel like they're looking over their shoulders. Mm-hmm. We want them to know that we were there, you know? So it's not like, and I have this thing always that I say, and I know I've said this to you, because I say it to every author I ever work with, which is that once the book is taken, it's taken. Then we can disagree, we can fight about what you go in and what you go out, but ultimately is the author's decision. And I know there were instances in the editing of your last book where I was very, very firm about some things that I didn't want, but ultimately, you know, the decision was yours. I mean, we would not have not published a book because we had taken the book. You, I feel like we've usually signed the contract first and then edited, or at least formally accepted the book and then edited, like not edited and said, like, let's see what happens. But maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that's
well. In each book is a little bit different, and it's so interesting to me. Like when I was talking with Carmen Jimenez Smith, and she has a book that's coming out with Grey Wolf, and I mean, pretty much everybody, I'm always interested in, you know, what are people's relationships like with their editors, mm-hmm. or their publishers, and also kind of I'm jumping around, but you know, editing and publishing are not the same thing, but I think we're living at a moment in literary history where most people are not getting a huge amount of editing from their editor.
I would agree with that,
and for better and for worse. It depends on the writer, on the editor, on the press, mm-hmm. on the situation, all of those things. And so I'm really interested, and I feel like that's a really underexplored relationship and topic on the podcast. Mm-hmm. But every time I try to like ask about that, people, I don't think necessarily for any, you know, strong reason. Like I just had the next episode's going to be with Erica Sanchez, who has her first book, mm-hmm. whose first book just came out with Grey Wolf. And, you know, I asked like, you know, how much did the book change? Like these were really ways of saying like, what was it like to work with Jeff Schatz, and mm-hmm. how did that go for you? And what was, and she, we didn't really go anywhere with that. So now, you know, here I am with you across a very narrow table in a very small room. And I want to talk about that, and we are talking
about it.
But it also it really strikes me, and you know, I'm obsessed with lines of provocation, right? Obviously, this is a
really
big topic
no.
for me. But you know, like, what's what is useful to make public that is usually stays private,
sure.
and what is either exploitative or just kind of needlessly provocative, like spectacle or, you know.
You mean in poems or just like in the discussing of this? I can't tell what you're talking about. Like,
yeah, yeah. Well,
because I mean, yeah, go
so
ahead. You're going
so in that. Poems, I am definitely interested in that.
Sure.
And then in my lectures, that was a big topic too. But what I'm realizing is that this moment feels very similar to me, where I feel like it feels useful to me to bring at least one editorial relationship, editor-writer relationship into the public sphere, to the extent that Commonplace is a public venue. But also, I'm having that feeling, right? Like, I'm having that feeling that I get in poems where I feel like, should I say this? And then, of course, every time I have that feeling, I, like, can't.
Sure. So what do you want to say?
Close it or, no, I don't even, it's not even like a one particular thing. It's like, it's more of a feeling of like danger, danger.
Well, but, so maybe in one way, what you're saying is that you understand now why some people might be reluctant to, you know, why Erica might, I mean, I don't know Erica at all, but yeah. Why she just might be cautious around that topic, because maybe you could feel like you could jeopardize. And I also do think I could imagine a person feeling that way. For me too, it's a very complicated relationship, obviously, because, you know, first of all, I mean, I'm on the other end of it too sometimes.
Sure.
So, and I'm really a poet. I mean, that's what I do. I happen to be an editor as part of making my living, and I've done it for a long time, but like, I'm not really, I'm like a peer trying to help somebody be their best person. And I think that they, you know, that's my job. It's like, we're making a book and it has to be as good as it can be. And we aren't a press. Wave is not a press. It just passes through whatever manuscript comes in.
Right.
And I kind of broadly speaking think there's like, I mean, in a very crude sort of way, you could say there's like two kinds of authors in a way, or maybe two modes. Sometimes authors can shift. And one is that person who comes in with that manuscript that's more or less done. And they are just, for whatever reasons, it's just like, and you're kind of line editing, or maybe you're like, that one poem isn't so great, or why don't you switch these around or whatever. But like, basically that's sort of how they work. And then the other people come in with more of like a larger body of work, and it's, and different things could happen with it. And that, and there's a lot, you know, some of the closest editorial relationships I've had have been more of the latter, and those can be, they're dynamic, they're personal, they're difficult at times. And all you can do is just, you know, I mean, try to just keep telling the writer that you're on their side. You understand them. You know the work better than anybody does. You want what's best. You don't. Why would you not want what's best? You know. But it is about trust, and sometimes that trust can break down. Mm-hmm. And that, when that trust breaks down, people need to change publishers, you know, or change editors, because it's, I mean, that can happen. But sure. It hasn't really happened with Wave, to my knowledge. But it's an intimate relationship for sure. And, you know, I don't think people would know from the books which way the manuscripts come in or what happens necessarily. But, you know, so I don't know if that, like, so I mean, I would definitely put you more in the second category, along with a lot of other writers on Wave. You know, mm-hmm. People who aren't quite as certain about the book itself necessarily, or maybe they have some ideas, but it's more fluid or flexible or something. I think that's cool. I think that often leads to books that are, you know, really have exciting structures, you know. But it is also difficult, obviously, because there's a lot of strong wills in the room, you know.
Strong wills, and also, I mean, I think this is maybe partly what I meant by power. As you were talking, you were saying, you know, you're primarily a poet, and I want to ask you in a minute, like, what your relationship is like with Michael Weegers, and you know, whether, you know, how being on both sides of it informs, you know, both the roles for you. But I had a flash as you were talking about particularly my middle son, and the moments in which, you know, he's very angry with me and will say things to me, and I just, he mothers me in the sense that he makes me into this figure of authority that I don't even, I'm like, what? I mean, when you have a little kid, of course you're in charge of everything, but not that, you know, not, you're not, you're not the parent that you fought against as a teenager until you have a teenager who is looking at you with right. exactly that look that you remember. And you're just like, wait,
God, I have that what? To look forward to.
And so in a way, I think, you know, and I'll be more explicit about it, but like I had a lot of things I put on you. And so like, I think that all the way through, you've sort of been like, wait, we're peers. This is collaborative. And I was, you know, often sort of putting you in that kind of parental role, or in the, you know, in a role where I was like, I'm pushing back. And you were like, against what?
I think that's true. I think that's true sometimes. I do also think that in, you know, the case there are times when I was explicit about things that I thought, you know, that. I mean, I did say sometimes some things that were pretty strong about your work that mm-hmm. I found, you know, were, you know, I just expressed strong opinions. So it's not like you're not being like nuts and thinking that maybe I was like pushing on you pretty hard. But I didn't think of it as being like a parent figure, but right. I could see easily how it would be experienced that way. But I just, it's tough, you know, because you're like, you know someone's work so well, and mm-hmm. you're just like, trust me, like this is not up to the snuff, it's not up to the mark, it's like just or it's this is a mistake for X, Y, or Z reason or whatever. And it's, of course, it's always an opinion, mm-hmm. but there are some people's opinions who are, I mean, I don't know, this is coming out in a weird sort of way, like I think that I have some special, you know, expertise at everything. It's not that, it's just that at some point, you know, you really do know someone's work.
But I know? Think...
It doesn't mean you're always right.
Right.
I mean, it's like, and so, and there's... And
there's different ways of knowing someone's yeah. work. Like, you yeah. know, my Doug Powell, I yeah. really know his work. I would be a terrible... I mean, he sends me or he reads me a new poem right. and I just love it.
Yeah, but you're not his editor.
Right.
I mean, no, it
right.
isn't.
You wouldn't so that's be good, not a way of... No, right. I'm just
but
his
we
fan.
Need those people. Of
I'm just his friend.
And I have lots of people like
right.
that, too.
Right, right. And so, okay, so, yeah. all right. So, yeah, what's your relationship like with your editor? Because you are, you know, as you say, you know, kind of a you're
well, I
a
fall
person.
More into the first category of people who are more likely to come with a manuscript that's more or less done. I'm just like, maybe because I've just spent so much time mm-hmm. putting books together. Mm-hmm. So when I show up with I'm usually showing up with something that is booky. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's in the way
have other people helped you get to that point? Like, do you have readers who
I have shown every book I've written to Joshua Beckman and Matt Rohr before I have sent it, mm-hmm. and they will tell me this poem should go or that's, and I sometimes will ask specific questions about, I'm concerned that I'm doing this too much, or is this clear here, or is this. You know, and particularly I remember in the last book, Matt was very helpful because he I had some questions about this certain things I was doing. Mm-hmm. And he told me where that it was good in the poems and different places where it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And it was super helpful. And I followed everything he said. And it was, and then I gave the manuscript to Michael Wiegers. And then Wiegers will have edits or he'll ask mm-hmm. me or something, whatever. But over the past couple of books, it's been more like it was worked through so much by the time he got it mm-hmm. that I think it was sort of more just like little bits here and there, questions and stuff like that, but not like huge. But I can imagine at some point, I mean, maybe even with the next book, who knows? Because I have a bigger, way bigger mess of work that's like sort of not, I don't see it how it's going to be a book exactly yet. So I could imagine more like just showing up with 100 poems mm-hmm. and just being like, I got some ideas, but I don't really know, like want to work on this together and see what we come up with. And it feels scary to me to mm-hmm. work that way. Like I've never done that, but it also feels like maybe that's why I should do it. You know, if it feels that way, like that if you know, that's sort of how I feel about poetry in general. It's like anytime, maybe it's like the mirror of what you said. Right. It's like that if I feel myself veering away from something, it's like, I think, oh, you know, I should, no, that's exactly what I need to do.
When you show the poems to Joshua Beckman and Matt Rohr, how far along are you showing them individual poems all the way, or are you showing them the man? Like
sometimes they see yeah. individual. So there's a small group of poets with whom bunch of us will share some work sometimes. I mean, I don't think we show each other everything, but there's a small group of people who I've known for a long time who are poets whom I respect, who I just, maybe if I'm really excited about something or if I have a question about it, I'll send it and be like, individual poems, if I have questions about them, Matt is a very good editor for me. Mm-hmm. He's very generous and sweet, as you know, but he'll laser in on the thing that's not happening. Mm-hmm. And he will tell me, like, I just sent him three poems and he was like, and I knew which one was the good one and the other two weren't as good. And I was kind of hoping he'd tell me the other two were. And he was like, this one is a really good one. And the other two, I'm not so sure about. I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it was like hoping against hope that maybe I was wrong. But of course, I knew I wasn't wrong. So about which one was good and which ones were bad. So, I don't do that a lot. But like sometimes I need just some kind of contact mm-hmm. with a peer who's, yeah. But I mean, no, when I show it to Joshua and Matt, that is... It's like a manuscript, like with a title and page numbers and everything. And I send it to them and I usually will just say, is there anything that should go? Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'll have a specific question. Like with Matt, what I did last time is I said, I have a tendency in my poem sometimes to do this thing with syntax where I'll just sort of, I like to stretch out the syntax and pull things apart or kind of like reverse them or whatever. And I'm doing it to create like a kind of emotional effect. It's intuitive. I like to sort of pull things apart and see how far they can go while still keeping with English language grammar. It's just that they can sound awkward a little bit or mm-hmm. be a little bit weird the way they enter in the mind of the reader. But I don't ever want that to feel contrived, or it's not having any effect other than just to be strange, or that it's just unreadably confusing. Mm-hmm. But I can't tell anymore sometimes. So there were points in the poems where I was just like, can you just tell me how this lands? Like, and he was very honest about that. He said, no, it's great. It's great here. See why you do it here. No, it seems like, why don't you say it straightforward here? Like what? And I was like, that's totally helpful. Mm-hmm. I needed that feedback from him. I could have gotten that from Uyghurs too. Actually, I could have asked him and he would have been helpful too, I'm sure. But I just...
Well, is that the process that you go through when you edit Matt Rohr and Joshua Beckman's work?
But I might be asking a different question, though. I'm not, uh-huh. not I mean, it just really depends on the person. Because, like, some people everybody needs something different. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs something different, Rachel. But like, oh, no, but I mean, each author needs something different. Right. So... if I don't know the person, like I try to figure out, maybe like what it is they're concerned about or whatever. But I don't know. I mean, and also the other thing is, with a lot of our authors, we publish multiple books. So both of us might be thinking, hey, let's make a different kind of book or let's try to push this a little bit or let's try to, go in a different direction. Or, I mean, what I like to do also is to pull out things that the author might not think is good and be like, I don't think this actually is great. Let's broaden things mm-hmm. I don't know. It just depends on the person. It's really...
Well, from my memory, and I could be rewriting history and also my perspective is totally biased, but it's really interesting for me to think about the difference between my imagined relationship with you from Museum of Accidents to The Pedestrians, because I think, like you said, everybody needs something different, and I needed two very different things for those different books. And Museum of Accidents, I mean, I've said this to you before, but it was so profound for me, confusing sometimes, maybe problematic, but profoundly important. To feel that you in particular and that someone wanted that book. And it was really about being wanted and being like that you were waiting for that book. Like, you'd heard me read these poems at KGB.
I invited you to read at KGB. It wasn't that I heard. I was hosting the KGB reading series along with Deborah. I invited you to read.
Yeah.
You read a bunch of poems.
Right.
And you read some poems that would eventually be in Museum of Accidents.
Yeah.
And I came after you afterwards and I said, those poems were incredible. I would be interested in looking at a manuscript that included those poems.
Right.
And you were like, well, I have some and I'm working on it. I was like, great. I was so finish the book and let's talk about it.
And those poems were part of another manuscript that was promised to Wesleyan, which I was really struggling with them over this book, which was very, very long and had like two very different kinds of, you know, poems in it and all this stuff. And so I started to think about like, oh, these are the poems that Matthew wants. And so I took those out of the Bad Wife Handbook. And those were like Matthew's poems, which, again, you were not involved in this daily, you know, imaginative landscape in which I was projecting all of these things onto you. They weren't crazy. You said, I like these poems and I would like to see them in as a book. But I think that I'd never had that experience. I'd only had the experience of, in a way, trying to convince someone else to like my poems, or even to convince someone that they were poems. That was very much my experience as a young poet, was of trying to send my work out into the world, or being in workshops, or being in, you know, whatever, and having people not only say like, I don't really like this, but say like, these aren't even poems. And so it's true, you know, I feel very grateful that Wesleyan published my first three books, but there was never a moment, for lots of different reasons, where I felt like they love this. Now, I know they wouldn't have published the books if they didn't like the books and believe in them. No, nobody does that.
I know what you mean, though.
But it was more personal.
And I mean, that's how we operated. I mean, I began with Brian Henry. I began Verse Press in 2000, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody we published was like that. I mean, we published people because we loved their poems and we wanted to publish them. Why else would we do it? We didn't get paid to do it. We did it out of, you know, a dedication, and it was mostly our peers we were publishing, sometimes people who were older, but basically young poets. And we were enthusiastic, and it was personal, and it was family in a way. It wasn't necessarily business, because there wasn't any money to be made. So we just did it by feel, and we did it by instinct. And, and you know, now with Wave, it's a little different. There's more people involved. For a while, it was kind of more or less just me.
Mm-hmm.
With Verse, I mean, there was people who worked with me or whatever, but I was like the main editor and I made all the decisions. But then when it became Wave around 2005, Joshua became the main editor, and then and Charlie Wright is our publisher. So there's a lot of voices, and now Heidi is a big voice too. And there's other people involved in making editorial decisions and recommendations. So it's far from being just me. It's a different feel, but basically it's still the same. We believe in you, person, as we believe in you as an artist. We're going to support you, but supporting you doesn't mean, you know, just like not being involved in your creative process.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some people who don't want to publish with Wave because they're like, we don't want these fucking dudes all up in our business, man.
Mm. You know, what year did Wave start?
Charlie took over Verse in 2005.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's a kind of thing, and it's one thing among many. You know,
right.
It's not, I mean, there's lots of other great people doing stuff. I mean, if Wave were the only poetry publisher, that would not be a good thing. But I mean, it's part of this big ecosystem. And so, yeah, so we're involved. We're super involved as editors. I mean, that's part of why, you know, I need to be a little more careful about how I get involved, because it's such a big task.
The editorial part of it.
Uh-huh. I mean, we don't just do things without, and we're like, great, they published it. Boom.
Right.
You know? I mean, like you said before, I mean, people don't have the resources or time or, you know, whatever to necessarily do that, but it's just what we've always done.
It's really interesting for me to think about imagining you kind of starting your poetry career, both as a poet and then someone who was like editing and publishing books, starting off mostly as friends, and you weren't teaching full time then. Oh. And so like this kind of progression, maybe, or this shift from a sort of passionate, instinctive kind of relationship to poetry all the way to this book that you just published, which is called Why Poetry, and in which I think that you do a really good job of keeping you communicate that same connection that you had to poetry initially, and that you still have to poetry, but you are speaking to an audience in a way that requires you, and you chose to do this, to demystify in certain ways, even to demystify your own reason for instinctively liking one kind of poem or another. Like you're trying to ask yourself, like, how do I, because you can't really write a book called Why Poetry and just say, you know, have the only sentence in the book be like, I like what I like.
Or because.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so, right. You know, and I think, like, when I think about all the things that have happened to you since you started, you know, since Wave became Wave, or even before, you know, now you have to explain yourself in the classroom. Now you know, you had, how long were you the poetry editor at New York Times Magazine?
A little over a year. That's an annual rotating appointment. So,
got it.
But I did it for a little over a year. Yeah.
Yeah. So you had to, you know, not explain your choices, mm-hmm. but you had to be in a certain way more explicit or more transparent about your sort of internal processes, I think, in all these different modes, or, you know, with your editorial work, you know, not just because I'm sure I'm not the only author who has asked you, like, wait, but why do you want me to do that?
Of course, everybody wants to know. It's a totally legitimate question.
Right. And so in a certain way, it seems to me like maybe the past, you know, 10, 15 years of your life have been about having to come to a place where you're more and more explicit about your internal, or your more externalizing of your internal processes.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, I would say that, so what happened really was, in 2006, for 2 months, Joshua Beckman, Travis Nichols, and I traveled around the country on this poetry bus that Wave had done, and we picking up poets, and we did and dropping them off or whatever. We did 50 cities in 50 days, and it was this. We were, you know, in this big bus, and in the middle of it, we were giving a lot of readings. We were reading almost every night, and we had a filmmaker on the bus who had a lot of bad ideas, but he was a very talented cinematographer, but he had a lot of bad, like, filmmaking ideas, I thought. But, like, he had one excellent idea, which was that when we would stop somewhere, he would get off the bus and go find person just at a rest stop or gas station or working there or whatever, and just say, do you want to hear a poem? And often the person would say yes. And then he would go get one of us, and we would stand next to the poem, and he would film us reading the poem to that one person. Personism, right? O'Hara mm-hmm. would have been very happy. So that experience, plus the experience of reading to all these different audiences, plus being on this bus with all these different people, really was a... It worked on me. And I started to think to myself, is there a way to make a poem that can operate in that anybody could respond to, that doesn't hold itself away from anyone, but also does everything that I want poems to do? Does that poem exist? Because I was hearing and experiencing a lot of poems that seemed to alienate people, but I liked them. And then I was reading a lot of poems that presented themselves as being, oh, so, quote unquote, this word I absolutely abhor, accessible, you know, but they were very good poems. And I was like, well, is there a space between that somehow? Does that exist? And more importantly, you know, is there a space for me there? You know, maybe, I mean, so I got interested in writing those poems. And those were the poems that started to form my third book. And, you know, I've gone on in various ways to sort of try to think through that issue, although other issues now as a poet are starting to become more important to me. But that was a dominating idea for me. Like, can I write a poem that anyone will, that any, that doesn't hold itself away from anyone, but also does everything that I love about poetry. Does that, what does that mean to me? And I think that that act, you know, in poems then also informed my desire to see if I couldn't do that with talking about other people's poems or poetry in general. You know, is that, so I would say the impulse really came originally out of a poetic one, you know, for me, and then became a prose one, if there's a word, were, and then, but I think now you, what you're saying about being an editor and being a teacher or whatever, of course, those things must also have been informing those experiences as well along the way. So yeah, it's not, maybe not as one dimensional as I sort of have it in my mind, that progression, that there were a bunch of things acting on me, you know?
Well, that's fascinating because, that's between American Linden and Come On All You Ghosts.
Well, there was a book in between there called The Pajamas.
Oh, right,
that was,
right, right.
That I wrote when
it's
I was in New
York.
Between
The Pajamas.
So I'd written that book and it was, you know, I think I just wrote my first two books. Honestly, I just really didn't, I mean, I knew theoretically people would read them, you know, and like, I mean, I understood that, but I don't think as a writer, as a poet, I was really thinking about that. I think I was thinking about poetry a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And my own experience being a poet and groping through different things and trying different things out and getting really excited about certain things and thrilled about, can I do this in poems and can I do that in poems? And I think that is a completely appropriate thing to do as an artist. I think that's great. But then I started to get interested in something else as I became a more public, but I was like, no, wait, actually, I am going to have to read these to people. I don't have to. I mean, I'm going to read these to people. There are other people, and I happen to care about that. I would totally respect if someone said, I don't care about that. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing, and that's people who like it. I'm not going to, you know, that's completely legitimate, but I'm just not that person. I mean, you could hear me in the beginning of the podcast, like trying to introduce the podcast for everybody because I'm so anxious. You know, so maybe that on the one hand is a kind of irritating quality I have. But on the other hand, maybe it's also, it's just who I am. So not being that person in my poems would be false to myself and my impulses. So I have to be that. And so, you know, it's been interesting for me to create that tension too in the poems. Like because there are such private moments the surrealists are my favorite authors of all. And I don't believe in, you know, I don't believe in like, you know, just only writing the most obvious thing. I mean, I love to mystify myself.
Well, I love this image of you on the poetry bus, and kind of looking, trying to think about what are the kinds of poems or what are the poems that you could just get off the poetry bus and read it to anybody, and it would be okay. And then sort of having all of these different experiences that led you eventually to another thought, which is maybe it's not about finding some certain kind of, or making some certain kind of poem, but it's a way, it's a quality of reading that, you know, that the poems that initially someone might not be receptive to when you get off the poetry bus, those poems in your life, whether they're by the Surrealists or Audre Lorde or W.S. Merwin or, you know, or Wallace Stevens, that poems that are not necessarily considered accessible, that you had something to say about the way in which those poems were accessible to you or became accessible to you through a certain kind of relaxing of anxiety around decoding or entering into a creative space as a reader that you had previously kind of been looking for as a writer only.
Yeah, right.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're, what I hear you talking about is genre, you know, which is, as I say in the book, is a really unfashionable idea right now, but I think thinking about poetry through the prism of genre, or the, that's not, prism isn't the right word, through the lens,
yeah,
right, of genre is useful because genre is really about purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that where people get tripped up, in my experience, most often with understanding poetry. I'm making like little air quotes with that understanding because I think that is a complicated word. But is they expect it to do something, or they think it has a purpose that is not what it's for primarily. So they get mad if it's not, if it doesn't tell a story or doesn't have a moral or doesn't have like just sort of a single message that they can boil it down to. So my job in the book really was to try to articulate what I think poetry's function or functions, let's say, are that are distinct from other uses of language. And that was a hard thing to do. But so the only way to do that was through different examples.
Yeah, can I ask you a quick question about that?
Sure.
Which is...
what are you talking about?
No, not at all. Why did you think it was your job to do that at all? I know why I thought it was my job to write about my poetics is because you asked me to, which was like a life-changing invitation. But you, like, what made you decide to write this book, Why Poetry? And I mean,
People get, I'll give you two answers. Because people always ask poets what is going on in poetry. And I felt bad that every time someone asked me that, I either rolled my eyes or didn't have anything to say or acted like it was a dumb question when it is not a dumb question. Mm-hmm. And it's a great question. And I just thought maybe I should try to answer it instead of being a dick, mm-hmm. you know? And so I did. And I didn't know when I started to do that whether it was an essay or I did it originally gave a lecture. There's a personal reason that I didn't really understand until I wrote the book, which is, you know, I mean, this is going to sound so cheesy, my God, but it's true. It's like, you know, I am the oldest son of a brilliant, complicated, successful, charismatic man who died about 10 years ago, the same brain tumor actually that John McCain has and Ted Kennedy died from, brutal, you know. And I don't think he and I had the chance to really talk about what I did. And we didn't get that chance you get maybe when you're older, you know, to like kind of process things a little bit with your dad as you settle into your life as a person, you know, whatever. So it's like I'm still a young man, relatively young man when he died. So I think part of it is talking to my dad. Mm-hmm. I mean, not in like literally I'm not talking to him, but like I think I was sort of that's a person who's there. And so, you know, it's like maybe I just wanted to feel like I needed to say some things, you know, that I didn't get to say. That wasn't the only reason, but I think that's part of it. I mean, it's funny when I gave the manuscript of Why Poetry to one of my editors, she said something like, oh, you know, she was complimenting before she told me all the things I did wrong, but she said, which is, yeah, good editorial practice. But, she said, oh, you know, you do the three main subjects of this book are so, you do such a good job. And I was like, three main subjects of the book. What are those? I can't wait to hear. She was like, yeah, you know, like how to read poems, you know, what they're for, you know, why they exist or whatever. And, you know, your dad. Mm-hmm. I was like, my dad, my father. So I went back to the manuscript. And I did like a find, like the, you know, Apple F, like uh-huh. father like search. And I was like, really couldn't believe how many times that word appears in the manuscript. You know, it's like, she was like, oh my God, you're right. I did write a book, you know, in some ways, and I didn't know I had done that. I mean, I knew I had touched on it a few times, but mm-hmm. like, if you'd asked me, it was like, so, you know, so part of it was that too. And, yeah. So do you want to hear the poem that I wrote? Like,
I do. Can you read a tiny bit from Why Poetry? Because I feel like I want people to,
sure.
To hear.
What do you want me to read?
Do
you want me to pick something?
Yeah.
Okay.
You pick something.
I can read like a really short.
Cause I feel like
section.
it's important. This book is really, unusual in the way that it is both, it really provides these fascinating close readings, and it also really is written to your father, but in a it includes all of these personal connective moments in your life, and then how poetry, you know, is a part of that. And so I
feel it's personal. Like, it's like, I mean, I didn't set out to make it that way, but it is. I didn't think I could talk about what I think poems do without sort of opening up about my own experience of coming to them, which happened relative. I mean, there were, I had a few experiences when I was younger, you know, like in high school or earlier or whatever, but I didn't really start writing poems or seriously reading them until I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And I was at UC Berkeley studying Slavic languages and literatures, and then I started, right? So I remember what it was like to start reading them. I mean, some people start when they're so young, you know, so they maybe don't even have a clear memory. They're like, I was always a poet or whatever, but that wasn't really true for me. So, but I'll actually read this little section. It won't take so long to read, which is, and one of the reasons is because it takes place very close to where we are right now.
Cool.
The events described take place in Posman's books, which was just, right, you know, two or three blocks from where we are right now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if at most, so. Not there anymore, but anyway. So, and it's the very first little section of this, of the last chapter in the book, which is called "Nothing is the Force That Renovates the World," which is, of course, is Dickinson. I mean, who else could that be but Dickinson? The first and I think only poetry reading I ever went to with my father was at a bookshop next to Washington Square Park in Manhattan. It was afternoon and there were two poets reading. I remember at lunch we had eaten and drunk to our satisfaction and beyond. So as soon as the first poet began, my father almost immediately fell asleep in his chair, leaning back his head, quietly snoring. I didn't wake him. The second poet began. His voice was much quieter than the first, and the whole room seemed to focus down into it. My father's eyes opened. His head snapped a bit alarmingly forward, and he stared at the poet the entire time while he read. Afterward, my father came up to me among the shelves and said, I loved that, even though I didn't understand it. He repeated that sentence over and over, confused and distressed. I didn't know what to say. A part of me wishes I had found a way just to ask him what the poems made him think of, what they brought up in his mind. I would have loved to hear it. It would have been such a different way of getting to know my father, impossible now. In the end, though, I know it was good for this experience to remain private. It could never have been truly translated or explained. To emerge from sleep, to hear the poems and follow and join them with a gradually waking mind, to understand them and even love them in a way that comes from language, but is beyond the ability of language to describe. This may very well have been a nearly perfect experience to have with poetry, especially for someone inclined to be skeptical of it. Despite its ordinary resistance to poetry, my father's sleepy, drifting attention slipped easily into the associating movement of the mind of that second reader, the great Slovenian poet Tomáš Šalamón, and then continued in its own private directions.
That's such a great section to read, because I feel like it both... it's very beautiful, and it really represents the beautiful, intimate, personal tone of the book. And also, I feel like one of the things that you talk about in poem after poem in different ways is that quality of attention and dream or imagination, and that kind of reverie that one can be in, and this thing that I think that that as poets and as readers of poetry that we, that's almost addictive, right? Mm-hmm. And it's this loving something that you don't fully understand, or that wonder of like not even knowing why you love the thing you just loved, almost despite right. yourself. And right. I think, you know,
well, I mean, I had written this whole book where I was more or less up on a soapbox, trying to be not too high up on it. But, you know, there's a kind of way that you can't avoid that. It's like it's you know, you're like, this is this way. It's not that way. This is, you know. And at the end of the book, I was happy with what I did. I mean, I really stood behind everything I said. It'd take me years to do it. But I also felt like I couldn't leave the book without making sure that the last word was about all the things I didn't know and mm-hmm. couldn't say, and all the things we can't say, and all the things that cannot be said. And because just to write a book that gave the impression that like I had all this figured out, or like that, or that it was figure outable at all, was just so antithetical to my entire life as a poet, as an artist, that I just, it made me sick to even think about it. So but also excited the fact that, oh, this last chapter is going to be about everything I don't know, everything that's beyond me, everything I can't say, everything that can't be said. And that was also the place to talk about Duende. It was the place to talk about Dickinson's refusals. It was the place to talk about Poetry Makes Nothing Happen. It was the place to talk some more about Stevens. And it ended up being the place to talk about my dad dying, like actually dying. And that was a shock when I wrote that. I was not expecting that. So yeah, it was that, I thought that was the end of the book. Of course, it didn't end up being the end of the book, it was almost the end, but I just couldn't do it. I mean, it was like, I just, that textbooky, like you can figure all this out. I mean, just, it's totally not what poetry's about, I don't think. So I knew that I needed to write that. Mm-hmm. It was very hard to write that chapter. It was like, it's hard. The whole book was hard, actually. But.
Will you read one of your new poems? Do you have them?
I think I do.
I mean, I loved hearing them yesterday. So we have this room until 3:30, and also probably you're exhausted and you're reading tonight.
I don't even know what time it is.
It's 3:09.
Okay.
I'm not good with time management.
I mean, I don't care. I don't want to go on forever because I don't want to bore this mythical audience that we.
No, they exist. You're part of. You're usually part of the audience. Look at this.
Well, they're mythical right now.
You're a poet and you're an editor. You're a listener. You're a guest.
What do you? Was there one that I read that you liked?
I mean, I love the Paul Ryan poem, but I also feel like that's more available than the other ones.
The poem's a little.
That's the one with the flashlights, right?
No, that poem is called December, and that's the one that's about
the lake.
The ghost ship fire. Yeah,
I like that one too. That's okay. Beautiful poem.
Right. So this poem is as I said yesterday, that I live in Oakland, California, and there's a lake. It's actually a lagoon. It's a man-made, human-made lagoon in the center of
nice
the
catch.
City. Yeah, got that too. It's sort of like the spiritual center of the city. It's where people come a lot of the time if there's some kind of public thing. It's people are around it all the time on weekends and stuff like that. So after the election, people came and sort of everybody was freaking out, and that was where, and everybody sort of held hands around it and held signs. But and then a few weeks later, there was this horrible fire in Oakland, the ghost ship fire, where a bunch of young people died. And so again, people came down to this at night and demonstrated. So anyway, so the poem is just called December. At first, we all went down to the lake to hold hands. All the multicolored signs said, "With love, we will resist." Over my head, I lifted my son so he could see what people look like when they hear the song Imagine. A few weeks later, again, people stood at the water, this time at night, holding flashlights to say to fire, "You came without permission and took our young, gentle soldiers for art. So we will show, even with our old technology, we can see each other without you." Others booed the mayor, which was, my friend said, understandable. I don't know what is anymore. Everyone understands in a different, contradictory way the so far purely abstract catastrophe so many millions of choices brought us. Not too far from the water, I sat on the couch, below the sound of blades, drinking amber numbing fluid, my thoughts chopping the air, feeling not, what is the word, to be a father equipped. Mine never told me where to hide a brick of gold. For a long time I have known no voices will come at last to tell us how to stop pretending. We don't know. If it is not safe for some, it is not for anyone.
So these new poems of yours, what's the relationship between them and why poetry? Like you must have written all of them during the same period of time or many
after,
of them.
Some after. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there is a direct, I mean, there must be, but I don't know really what it is. I mean, I think honestly, you know, it was funny because the whole thesis of the book is that you write poems and you read poems for something different than you get from prose. And that was totally enacted in my experience because I missed writing poems. Mm. And then when I got back to writing poems, I was like, oh yeah, this is that kind of thinking that I can't do in prose and still be, I mean, you can do some of it in prose, but you can't really do it in prose. I mean, maybe you've had this experience writing these lectures, I don't know. But I definitely had that experience and I was like, oh, I miss that poem writing thing. And I felt so relieved to get back to it. And I was like, this is where I really work out these issues, you know, cause I can be confused and also direct. And yeah, it just felt right to me to be back. So not necessarily easy, but like back, you know. So
I mean, I see so much overlap between the new poems and the concerns of the book, and also maybe not just the concerns, but the freedom of the poems. Mm-hmm. But also your ability to combine the personal with the theoretical, which I think was present in your poems before, but it feels present in a slightly different way now. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I don't feel, and when I say free space, like I don't mean, I mean freed from the usual things. Mm-hmm. And then other things that are deeper, the deeper obligations, the human animal obligations become archetypal. They become these forces. They push you one way and then the next way and the next way in the poems. And that's what I mean about a free space. I don't mean a free space, like a gravity-less space or a space with no concerns. I mean, Stevens has that great line where he says, the all-commanding subject matter of poetry is life. And I believe that's true, but life in what way? I mean, maybe not the usual ways we have of talking about everything. And that's why when I'm teaching, you know, a lot of the time, a big part of what I'm doing is just trying to point out to my students where they become euphemistic, mm-hmm. or where they're just language is just, you know, kind of papering over or like, you know, eliding like a deeper relationship, but what's deeper might be ultimately expressed in a much simpler language, less poetic language. It's possible, you know, it's often the case.
What's coming next for you? It seems like you have you're still teaching very intensively. You're teaching at St. Mary's and also at the Low Residency program, right?
In not that anymore.
I
teach at St. Mary's and occasionally do summer stuff. Yeah.
So you still have a million things on your plate. You're a dad, you're a husband, you're a teacher, you're a poet, you're still an editor, but you finished this book. So there must be a little bit of space.
Pulling back, being much less of a public person, not getting involved in so many projects. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've also been directing this lecture series, as you know, that was a huge project. I mean, I just need to do less. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been manically busy for the past several years. I don't think it's sustainable in terms of my spiritual or physical self. I think it's not. I'm turning 50 in a month or so, and it's just maybe time to just be not quite as involved in things, and that's just my impulse right now. Mm-hmm. I think I just need to be home and quiet and like writing poems and reading and thinking more and less like rushing off to do the next thing. So I hope that's what's next. Mm-hmm. I need that.
It's so hard to do that, isn't it?
Yeah. I think you have to just start saying no, I guess, to things. And it's really hard to say no to some things because you know, people, your friends or your colleagues, or they need stuff. But I think there comes a point where you just have to be like, look, I'm not doing this for a while. Like, I'm sorry. You're just going to have to ask someone else. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a really interesting opportunity. I'm so flattered, or I'm honored. It's like the kind of thing that I would have died to do 10 years ago. But I just, if I do that, I won't make any poems.
Right.
You know, and that's why, in a way, it was a tough decision to do the Times editing thing, because I knew it was going to be a ton of work. But it was such a great opportunity to put forward work that I believed in, and just it seemed like such a cool project, and it was a limited amount of time, so I figured, I'll do it. But I don't know, that kind of stuff is really, it means fewer poems. Mm. It just does. And so it's like there's not an unlimited amount of time, and so I have to just now think, okay, like, do the math. Basically,
do you have a title for the new manuscript?
No, I've thought about some different things, but I have also this whole other group of poems that almost no one has seen. Mm-hmm. Showed a few people, and it is a very, very peculiar body of work that is much different. Feels much different to me. It's written more like, it's not out of my own life at all. It's mm-hmm. It's a different persona. I'm calling now, I'm just the man that those poems, I call my heteronym. That's what they are. They're a different person writing them, and they're written with a different process, and they are immensely pleasurable to write, and they are like really just super involving as a writer. But I don't know whether they are going to be publishable or of interest. I mean, I just have no idea yet.
That's exciting.
Right. But that's a private writing act that I think I probably just also really, really needed that. And so we'll see. Maybe there'll be a few poems or that'll come out of it, and they'll just be folded into the rest of the stuff or not. Who knows? But it's, I know, we feel like we keep looking like over out the window.
I know. Is there someone out there?
I think they're just people, but they're not. But we are projecting like our anxiety that it's like, you know, onto them. They're like, they're just minding their own business out there. Like, I don't know what they're looking at, something else. They're not looking at us, but.
All right. Well, this was really great. I wish we could talk for longer.
Well, it's just one among many future conversations, I'm sure. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Okay, hold on. This has been episode 44 of Commonplace, Conversations with Poets and Other People. I'm Rachel Zucker. Commonplace producers are Nicholas Fuenzalida, Christine LaRusso, and James Ciano. Our advisor in all things is Daniel Schiffman. Music written and performed by Moses Zucker-Gorin. Design work by Eitan Darwish. Thank you so much to our patrons, to the presses that support Commonplace, and to you, our listener. Happy New Year, and take care. Thank you for listening.